Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. I'm Stephanie Domingo.
I'm Tux Lurzel.
And we be drinking and we be swearing.
Fuck!
Wow.
Sorry.
Wow, a look of shock is spread upon my face. Wow. Okay, I don't know how to act. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government. Wow. Did you write that in your outline?
No,
is that why you
came
said
to
it?
Me. I had a vision of swearing.
Tux thinks he's so big because he can swear now, like the adults.
Yes. I don't have to sit at the kids' table anymore. I have some four-letter words in my arsenal that aren't like darn. Drats. That's five letters.
It's okay.
Here we are.
Tis us.
So today we are drinking some fancy ass pina coladas.
Yes.
Frozen, frosty.
We like pina coladas.
Oh, we'll get there.
Oh, really?
We're going to be talking about that. Yeah.
Okay.
Little did you know, ooh, you just set it up perfectly. We've got some frosty hurricane glasses with some pineapple and little cocktail parasols.
Yes.
Like we're in a fancy restaurant in the 70s.
Like we're in a floater in a pool.
Yeah. My story today is from the late 70s. And so I was kind of Googling like what drinks were popular in the 70s. And basically, most of these cocktails reminded me a lot of the drinks that came up when I was Googling the drinks for the 80s when you did the line dancing scandal.
Oh, yeah. Square dancing.
So it was like the same kind of stuff, like really sugary, fruity, like kind of artificially flavored sort of stuff. Mm-hmm. The main difference between the 70s and the 80s for cocktails is there was not nearly as much variety. There were a lot more options in the 80s.
Yeah.
In the 70s, there really wasn't much, but everything that there was like syrupy and over the top. I actually asked my mom, because she was young at the end of the 70s, mm-hmm, like, what were you drinking when you were gallivanting?
Yes.
And she was like, most people just drank beer.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Easy. Accessible.
People would drink a lot of screwdrivers, she said.
Ew.
I know.
Ugh.
I can't drink a screwdriver. I was like, maybe we should drink screwdrivers, but no.
No.
Gross.
Yeah. It just feels so lazy,
yeah,
too.
She said she liked to drink slow gin fizzes a lot.
Ooh. Those are delicious.
Yeah. But it didn't really make sense with my story, so I decided to go with the pina colada instead. But she did tell me that there was this dance club kind of
she was up in the
disco
club
that she used to go to on the outskirts of our hometown called the College Inn.
Okay.
That she said there was a $2 cover to get in, and that included the cost of drinks. $2.
What?
And then you had free drinks all night.
Oh.
But the only options for drinks were cheap beer.
Okay.
And screwdrivers made with tang instead of orange juice.
Ew. Ew.
So gross.
Yuck.
And then she told me that, like,
so, okay, they don't want people to drink, basically.
Well, they wanted people to just get shit-faced and,
okay,
like, dance, you know?
Dang.
Yeah. But she said later they raised the price to $3, and people were like, oh, my God.
Too rich for my blood.
Yeah. Given the story that I'm about to tell, we probably should just be drinking, like, cheap beer, because that's what people would have been drinking. But then, you know, that's not fun.
It's
we don't
fun.
Have a recipe to share with you guys, so.
Yeah, we brew our own cheap beer.
Artisanal PBR. So I chose a pina colada, as you know. They were big at the end of the 70s. My story today is kind of islandy and tropical, and it just felt appropriate, even though the people in my story were probably just drinking cheap beer.
Okay.
One of the big reasons that pina coladas were so popular at the end of the 70s was the song Escape, a.k.a. the Pina Colada song by Rupert Holmes, the one that you sang.
Oh, I thought that was, what's that one dude who has all the bad songs that,
Weird Al?
No, I think he has his own brand of liquor.
Oh, Margaritaville.
Yes!
Yeah.
Yes, yes!
No, it's a different... Margaritaville is a totally different thing. This is Rupert Holmes that sang the
Mind
Pina
blown.
Colada song. Also, if you actually ever listen to the lyrics of the Pina Colada song, that song is really freaking weird. The song essentially is about a
sex
couple. The gist of the song is that there's this couple that is bored with each other, and the man puts an ad in the paper for a woman who likes pina coladas because he wants something more exciting in his life. So he wants somebody that's like freer and would drink pina coladas with him and all the other things that he lists in the song. And then his girlfriend or wife or whoever it is finds this ad in the paper, doesn't realize it's him and responds to it because she is also bored with their relationship. So the whole basis of the song is this couple wants to cheat on each other because they're so bored with each other.
Okay.
But when they go to do it, they meet each other.
How awkward.
And then they just sort of like realize that they need to be more fun and they live happily ever after sort of thing.
This should be a movie.
Yeah.
Not a terrible song.
I remember the moment that I was listening to that song and actually like heard the lyrics for the first time and was like, wait a minute.
I don't think I've ever heard the lyrics.
What the fuck are they talking about?
Wow.
Yeah.
You follow the story and you're just like, your eyebrows are just getting more and more furrowed. Yeah, yeah. You're like, wait a second.
Yeah. So that song is why Pina Coladas were so big at the end of the 70s.
Okay.
A little bit of history of the Pina Colada. There's a few different sort of origin stories, which I've mentioned this before, but it's hard with cocktails because people are drunk. There's not a lot of cocktails that really have like a solid, indisputable.
I like that you say people were drunk as you look directly at me. I could see you. Okay, go on.
One story says that they were invented by a 19th century Puerto Rican pirate who gave his crew a drink that contained a mix of coconut, pineapple juice, and rum as a way to sort of like boost morale on the ship. Historians say that this is
not true.
Dubious at best.
Damn, sounds like a good one.
The most sort of like accepted origin story is that they were created by a bartender at the Caribe Hilton Hotel in San Juan in 1954. The bartender said that he felt that the Pina Colada captured the true nature and essence of Puerto Rico.
Okay.
But some people also dispute this, saying that there was a reference to a pina colada in an earlier article about Cuba, I think in the New York Times.
Hmm.
But then there's another like restaurant in Puerto Rico that claims that they invented it later, like in the 60s. It's murky.
Okay.
But in the end, in 1978, Puerto Rico proclaimed the pina colada as their official drink. Even though my story has nothing to do with Puerto Rico today, we're drinking Puerto Rico's official cocktail because they are tasty and islandy and 70s-y.
I love it. So we should cheers.
Yes, cheers.
Clink.
Clink, clink.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
So tropical. I love a pina colada.
Mmm. Another sip now.
Yes.
I need to get into this and I know I'm not going to be able to drink. Today, I'm going to be revisiting the Marshall Islands.
Oh, no. Oh, no. Nothing good happens there.
Nope, nothing. Yeah. So
we make this beautiful cocktail that's so like light and fun. It tricked me.
Yes, I know. I found this story sort of
in the same time.
Researching the Castle Bravo story. And I thought about doing them one right after the other, but I was like, this is too much. I need to take a breather. I need to sort of circle back. So
yes. Okay.
I did a couple episodes in between and here we are back in the Marshall Islands. Sort of as a little bit of a reminder, nuclear testing started in the Marshall Islands basically right at the end of World War II. In 1946, we started with Operation Crossroads, and nuclear testing went on all the way up until 1962, just before we signed that nuclear test ban treaty. A little background on how we were able to do this, like why we were allowed to just take over the Marshall Islands.
Seriously.
And blow shit up.
Yeah.
The Marshall Islands were used by the Japanese during World War II as
which
sort of like a base.
Which would make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then because apparently after the war was over, we still considered Japan an aggressor and it wasn't officially over with Japan. So we took the Marshall Islands over from Japan because of World War II.
We took it over and just never left.
Like at the end, yeah.
Okay.
We took it over. So we started with Operation Crossroads in 1946, but then in 1947, we reached an agreement with the United Nations that they would grant us a strategic trust on the islands of Micronesia, which include the Marshall Islands. Mm-hmm. It includes about 2,000 islands spread out over 3 million square acres of the or square miles of the North Pacific Ocean. This was the first and last time a strategic trust would be granted by the United Nations. So as part of this trust, we were supposed to help enrich the Marshall Islands. We were supposed to build schools and build infrastructure and hospitals.
You said this is the last strategic trust?
The first and last.
Oh, first and last. Okay.
Yes.
Okay,
there have been other trusteeships, but this is the only strategic trust. So it ends up being sort of like the whole thing was specifically seen as sort of like a military maneuver overseen by the UN Security Council instead of like the General Assembly.
Okay.
Yeah. But as a part of our agreement, we were supposed to do good things in the Marshall Islands. But once we got control, we were like, I'd rather just blow shit up. Basically, as soon as we got this, like within a few days, the United States Atomic Energy Commission named...
Within a few days?
Yeah.
Shit.
We named our sort of newly acquired testing area the Pacific Proving Grounds. And it was like, we're just going to go in and blow...
Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yeah.
Because I'm guessing they had to submit some sort of proposal.
Oh, they knew to... They knew they were getting what they wanted. You know, how long does it take for Congress to do anything? And it was within days that it was... They're like, yes, we approve.
Wow.
I mean, we've tested a lot of nuclear weapons over the years, but we saved our biggest and most dangerous weapons for the Marshall Islands because they're pretty remote. 67 of the largest weapons we've ever developed were tested, accounting for 80% of all of the fallout we've ever created. Even though we were testing in Nevada and all over the place, 80% in the Marshall Islands. Yeah. So you may remember from the Castle Bravo story that we had evacuated Weetok Atoll and Bikini Atoll in 1946 in advance of a lot of the testing that we did. But when we did so, we promised the Marshallese that they would be able to return to their native homes once we were finished blowing shit to smithereens. Yeah, about that. That's going to sort of be the focus of my story, what happened to, especially Weetok Atoll, after the testing was finished. In 1962, the people of Bikini and Weetok sued the United States government because they had been basically in exile. They were told that they'd be able to return soon, and it had been over 15 years that they'd been in exile from their traditional homes that they've been living on for thousands of years.
Wow. Where were they?
They were relocated to other atolls that were further away, but many of them were not large enough to support that number of people. Yeah. I mentioned in the Castle Bravo test that people were found starving. Like, it was so fucked up.
Ooh.
So they sued the government saying that they either wanted compensation for being removed from their homes or permission to return and resume their traditional lifestyles. By this point, by 1962, the government already knew that we had fucked shit up.
There's no going back to these islands. Yeah. They're irradiated.
Yeah, exactly. They were much more contaminated than we ever said that they would be. We knew what we were doing, but we...
Yeah.
It's only a few hundred people. What are they going to do? So we just did what we wanted to do.
Yeah.
But the government agreed when this lawsuit came up, they agreed to launch an investigation to see if any of the islands could be cleaned up and returned to the Marshallese people. It would take 15 years for all the various branches of the government to figure out who was responsible for what and how would they would go about this cleanup if they went for it. There was so much fallout from Castle Bravo.
What kind of cleanup can they really do?
Yeah. How do you clean up all this fallout? It's everywhere.
Look at Chernobyl. Yeah. There's no cleaning up that shit.
Yeah. They knew that Castle Bravo had created way too much fallout and that Bikini was basically unsalvageable. So the people who had lived on Bikini originally were relocated. They were just like, I'm sorry, we can't do anything.
Mm-hmm.
Have another island. Go live somewhere else. And Weetok, however, the government basically was like, there are a few islands on Weetok. I mean, an atoll, do you know what an atoll is or what it looks like?
It's a chain of island, right?
They're sort of like in a circle. It would be almost like the rim of an underwater volcano. And so there's like a bunch of little islands in a circle with a lagoon in the middle.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Now I understand from your photos on Instagram. Yeah.
They were like, okay, so there's a few islands on Weetok that are large enough to support life, and we think that we can clean them up. So Bikini's out, but let's try to clean up Weetok.
Okay.
Despite the fact that 43 separate nuclear tests were done on Weetok alone, just in that one atoll, 43 tests of the largest weapons we could get our hands on. So the southern islands of Inuitok were used as a base for the scientific task force that was there to monitor the tests and sort of study what was going on. And because they were used as a base, there were no weapons detonated on those islands. So they were like, okay, these are the least contaminated. That's why we think that we might be able to clean these up in some way. The northern islands of Inuitok, though, like I said, 43 separate nuclear tests. They had seen the bulk of the testing and the subsequent fallout and were considered the most contaminated and unsavable, especially Runet Island. Runet Island is a narrow 75-acre island to the northeast of Inuitok. It is the most contaminated of all of the islands in Inuitok. 11 separate tests were done on this one island alone. In this whole island chain, 11 tests, including the Quince test, which had gone horribly wrong. According to Michael Gerard, the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University, one of the attempted nuclear weapons explosions didn't work. So the plutonium was just broken apart by the conventional explosion, leading to about 400 little chunks of plutonium that were spread around the island.
Whoa.
On Runet Island, there are two large craters. I mentioned in the Bikini Atoll Castle Bravo story that Castle Bravo was so large that it basically vaporized an entire island. Runet Island was a little bit larger, and these explosions were a little bit smaller. So the island is still there, but there's these two big craters. One of them is sort of off to the side, and one of them is like right on the edge of the island.
Mm-hmm.
They're huge, but the island is still there.
Okay.
So the larger of the two was called the Cactus Crater, and it was named after the cactus test that created it. So the plan for the cleanup was that they would go to these southern islands, find any sort of contamination and debris, dig it up, and then go line the bottom of the Cactus Crater with concrete, and then dump all this shit into the crater, and then like cover it up, and be like, oh, you're good. We got it. Go back and live here now.
Concrete.
Yes. So the budget for this cleanup effort was $40 million, the initial budget. So they go to Congress and they're like, let's have $40 million for this. This cost would include the, excuse me, I just belched a little. Heavens. So the initial budget for the cleanup was $40 million, which would include the cost of bringing in specialists and private contractors and sort of like experts on this kind of thing. And so they go to Congress and they're like, we need $40 million to do this. And Congress is like, well, that's a lot of money. Why should we have to pay all this money to like clean up our own mess that we fucked up? Like, why should we have to do this? So Congress is like, why don't we give you $20 million instead? And instead of bringing in private contractors,
oh, no.
Pay enlisted men to do it. The U.S. Army.
No!
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Whoa, what the fuck?
Yeah. Side note, they actually couldn't even find any private contractors that would be willing to do this.
Of course, because you're going to
die. Yeah.
You're going to die being in this irradiated environment.
Yeah.
Where no one is supposed to be standing, let alone living.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay.
So Congress is like, here's $20 million, but like, just send a bunch of servicemen.
Oh.
So cleanup officially begins in 1977.
Oh, no.
They send 4,300 servicemen from the Navy, Army, and Air Force. Most of them like 18, 19, 20, maybe like 23.
Yeah.
They're kids. So they send them in for the first comprehensive project to clean up and rehabilitate a former nuclear test site. They're told that they're going for a six-month humanitarian project on a tropical island.
Oh, so they were lied to.
Yes. It sounds like paradise.
Oh.
It is not. It is the opposite of paradise.
I don't even know why they would say that. Because they get there.
A humanitarian project.
Yeah, they get there. There's no one there to, like, save.
Yeah.
They're just filling in a hole and slowly getting sick.
Yeah, so Army veteran Mark Sargent said, nothing was explained other than we were just going to work on the islands to return it to the Marshallese.
Okay.
It was a testing ground and on a need-to-know basis. We would learn more when we got there.
Oh, like how being poisoned field.
Yeah, exactly.
Field. Oh, rum. Making me look illiterate.
Felted. So there were two main like areas of focus for the cleanup effort: debris and soil contamination. The debris mostly consisted of damaged military equipment and like busted up concrete and scrap metal that was sort of left over from the base there that the Japanese were using, which was highly irradiated.
Debris,
yes. In the words of Katharine Hepburn.
Yes.
More debris.
I'm just like, what is she saying?
Yeah, I know.
Okay.
Look at you. I'm rubbing you, rubbing off on you.
You are. I watched this. What was the name of the movie?
Suddenly Last Summer.
That movie was dark.
It's super dark. It's one of my favorite movies. It's very a Tennessee good, Williams. Though. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very good, but it's very kind of funny in a really sick way.
Yeah. It's
not funny.
It's
funny
a super dark movie. Word. The one funny thing is that Katharine Hepburn says debris instead of debris.
Her character to me is funny because it seems so insane and over the top.
Yeah.
I salute you.
So in addition to all this debris...
Thank you.
There's also 400 pounds of big chunks of plutonium just laying around that they have to pick up. Jim Andrall...
Do they know what it is when they...
They know that it's plutonium once they get there and they're told what they're doing. But they didn't know what they were getting themselves into.
Okay.
Jim Andrall from the U.S. Army's 84th Engineer Battalion says that they were ordered to, quote, walk around and pick up loose pieces. Just gather up whatever we could and throw it in a pile.
What kind of suits were they wearing? Okay, you're going to get there.
We're going to get into that, too.
I have so many questions, but I'm going to stop interrupting. I'm sorry.
No, you're asking very good questions. Yeah. Basically, they're supposed to be wearing protective suits, and they're told that they're going to be given protective suits.
Okay, go on.
So, in addition to the debris... There's also the soil contamination that they need to take care of. So because these few like larger southern islands where there was a base, the whole purpose of this mission is to make them livable. They need to make sure that it's safe to grow and eat food there. So the soil contamination, like the goal of this project was to go in and remove all the sand and soil and like coral and everything to a depth that the roots of coconut trees and bread tree roots wouldn't be able to reach any radiation or contamination underneath the soil. So they go in and like dig up all this soil and sand, throw it into a barge and send it up to the crater to dump into the crater. And then they bring in new clean soil and sand that's not contaminated and put it back. So that's supposed to make it so that it's safe to grow and eat food there.
That is stupid.
I mean, how do you clean this shit up? Like, literally, what are you supposed to do?
You can't.
Exactly.
And you don't.
Yeah.
Because it's a fool's errand.
It shouldn't have happened in the first place, but it's too late now.
It's too late now.
Yeah.
But it is a fool's errand.
Yeah.
This is... What a waste of money.
So speaking of money, so Congress, like I said, Congress was like, oh, we need to save money. We're not going to pay private contractors. We're going to send in enlisted men, servicemen. A handful of congressmen
they
were like...
They should have just given these people... The $20 million.
Seriously. Absolutely.
Say, like, we fucked up. Our bad.
Yeah.
I'm sorry your homeland is destroyed and we did it, but this is a small consolation, but your homeland is gone.
Yeah.
There's nothing we can do.
I mean, hindsight is 2020. Yeah.
Your homeland has been gone.
Absolutely. Yeah. But so because Congress wanted to save money, there's like a handful of congressmen. They're like, hey, maybe we should like make sure it's safe for people to do this. We're sending in all these enlisted men. What about their safety?
Oh.
Just a couple of them.
Yeah, I wasn't like, what?
Yeah. So the Defense Threat Reduction Agency goes ahead and tells Congress that these enlisted men were given all the briefings they'd need on potential risks associated with working and living on Inuitok. They were informed about the dangers of radiation and given all the information they needed on proper safety procedures for cleanup, as well as the risks involved with things like sunburns, because they're on a tropical island in the middle of the ocean.
Who fucking cares about sunburns?
I mean,
when you're getting irradiated.
Yeah. With sunburns, swimming and fishing on the atolls. They were very concerned about the dangers of like living on an island. Ugh. In addition to these briefings and all the information they were supposed to get, they were also supposed to be given personal protective equipment, including those big yellow radiation suits, safety suits, and respirators that would prevent the inhalation of radionuclides. However,
there's always the
veterans who actually worked on Inuitok tell a very different story of what happened to them. Army vet John Bainan said, "The first thing they were supposed to do when we got into the main island was give us a safety briefing. I remember some kind of briefing, but the only thing I remember is watch out for sharks."
What?
Yeah. Another veteran remembers catching and eating local fish, lobster, and octopus in the lagoon for months before anyone ever told him that the waters of the lagoon and the fish inside could be contaminated with radiation. Many of the veterans also deny that they were ever given enough protective equipment and gear to wear. The only extra items...
I'm sorry to interrupt.
No, go ahead.
No one knew about radiation in the 70s? We knew about radiation
They were told that it wasn't that bad. They were told that the island emitted no more radiation than a dental x-ray.
Really?
Really.
Oh.
So Jim Andrell says the only extra items he ever received were some flea powder and a pamphlet on how to avoid heat stroke. It's so fucked.
That's really, really terrible. Unbelievably terrible. Heat stroke. Mm-hmm. That's what'll get you out here. Okay.
Paul Laird, who is an Army veteran who was a bulldozer operator for the earth-moving operation, says that he was asking his superior officer for a paper dust mask every day and was told that the dust masks were on back order.
They didn't have anything to protect their breathing, like nothing to protect their nose and mouth.
And they're moving like contaminated soil.
After I made such an issue about having a dust mask, my lieutenant at the time told me, well, if you're that concerned about it, just take your t-shirt off and wrap it around your head.
Wow, that's so messed up.
In an interview with the New York Times, Tim Snyder says, on his very first day on Inuitok, he was ordered to put on a respirator and a protective suit by his, you know, the Army officials. They took a bunch of pictures of him on the island in this respirator and
suit.
Stop it.
Yes, they took it away?
They told him to give it back, and he, quote, never saw one of those suits again.
Oh, that is fucked up. Mm-hmm. So they had a suit. They could have had suits, plural, for everyone. It was a photo op.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh.
Veteran.
That's really, really disturbing.
Yeah.
That these people are disposable. These people that we value so highly on, you know, Veterans Day, we claim to at least. Like, we're going to kill a 19-year-old.
I mean, it's despicable. It's, I mean, there aren't words.
So the sergeants, too. The people who are there, they don't have suits?
I mean, there were some, but not enough for everyone. And I think I'm going to get into this, but like, people didn't wear them because it was too hot, too. Veteran John Bainan says that they were told to wear these protective suits, but that temperatures on the islands could reach 132 degrees during the day.
Yeah.
And that people were fainting.
I think if they were given the true truth about the island...
Oh, they would be wearing the suits.
It's like you wear the suit and then you get to live.
Yeah.
They would be wearing these suits, maybe working a shorter shift.
Yeah.
So they can tolerate the heat, but they would be wearing those suits.
He said, you don't get the job done with people dropping over. So everyone wore jungle fatigues cut off into shorts, t-shirts, combat boots, sunglasses, and maybe boonie hats. That was basically our safety equipment. They're wearing shorts and t-shirts.
That's crazy. And it's awful that I'm thinking of like... Short shorts?
It was the 70s. So.
Yeah.
So whether the suits weren't available or just weren't used doesn't really fucking matter.
No.
The bottom line is these are basically kids.
Yeah.
Running around a tropical island in shorts, picking up chunks of plutonium and breathing in radioactive dust and sand without proper protective gear. 1/1,000,000th of a gram of plutonium can potentially cause cancer decades after first exposure. Ken Kasich said... It was a very dirty operation. When those bombs go off in Inuitok, that's coral sand that just gets pulverized and comes back down as baby powder.
Yeah.
And it was on everything.
It's everything. Everywhere. Yeah, of course. Of course. It's powder. You're breathing it in.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's...
Yeah. Jim Andrell said, I never had any clue that that dust could literally get into your lungs. You breathe it, you drink it, you eat it, you swim in it.
Yeah.
Every day for 6 months.
Yeah.
24/7.
Oh, you sit in it in your short shorts?
Yeah. Ron Madden said that he was given a respirator mask when he worked on a bulldozer, but that the mask had to stay with his equipment when he wasn't using it. So he would take it off and set it on the equipment, and then it would sit there collecting this radioactive dust before the next person would come along and put it on their face.
Oh, because they're doing construction. So they're like moving things around and throwing it up into the air. Mm-hmm. And then it's raining down upon them.
Yeah. And then at the end of their shifts, so they're putting all this debris and sand and stuff into a barge.
Debris.
It's called
debris.
And then, so they would then pile into the barge and ride with it back to Runet to dump it into the crater before they went back to their camp. Outside of the actual cleanup operations, these men were living on the islands that they were cleaning. They pitched their tents on contaminated ground and used desalinated local water for drinking, showering, and washing their clothes. The main base camp was on Lojwa Island, which is just 5 miles from Runet, the most contaminated island there. They put up tents and metal hooches on these concrete pads.
What's a hooch?
I looked it up. It's like a big-ass tent or like a kind of like a metal army structure. But the concrete itself is made from contaminated sand and soil and water.
What a fucking mess.
I know. One veteran remembers being told not to turn on his Geiger counter because it would tick so much that it would keep people up at night. So they're spending their days doing all this, like, it's arduous work. It's heavy lifting. It's they're operating bulldozers. They're picking up all these big pieces of concrete and stuff. But then at night, they kind of had free rein to, like, go back to Lojwa and act like 18-year-olds, act like 21-year-olds, like they were. Mark Sargent said, "I think they gave us beer to flush out our systems. We were called the Lojwa Animals. We were wild. We put on little beer bellies," he said. "We were men full of testosterone."
Okay.
So the army's like, "Here, just get drunk. It's fine.
Yeah.
Have a good time."
Okay.
Some of the guys brought cameras with them. They're going to the tropical island, so they're like, "This is going to be great." So they bring these cameras, and there's a bunch of pictures you can find online. And they look like pictures of my dad, like pictures of my uncles from, because they're about the, my parents are that age. Uh-huh. So like they would have been.
They could have been there. Yeah.
These guys were partying. Like there's all these pictures of them back at camp at night when they were drinking and partying. And it's like, it literally is looking at pictures of my dad, my uncles from that time, from the late 70s.
18 is so young.
So young. The Defense Department swore up and down that these guys were safe, that it was a perfectly safe operation. They said that there was a program in place to monitor potential exposure to radiation, especially from inhalation and ingestion. Plutonium on its own doesn't necessarily pose a risk to people as long as it's not inhaled or ingested. With inhalation or ingestion, though, it can lead to cancer, tumors, bone density loss, infertility, all sorts of fun stuff. People who were in charge of this operation put up these air samplers, downwind of the earth moving operations, and there were these like filters inside, and it was supposed to, every couple hours, they were supposed to go in and take out the filter and check it to see if the dust that the air samplers were catching was radioactive. So that they could be like, oh, these guys should be wearing the gear or whatever because the dust we're collecting is dangerous.
Okay.
But surprise, they were usually broken. According to an Energy Department memo in 1978, only 1/3 of the air samplers tested were actually functioning. They also used these things that were called film badges. You would sort of like put it on your...
Oh, yeah. And it detects and it changes it's supposed color, to, right? Or something?
It's supposed to detect potential gamma radiation.
Yeah.
However, because of the heat and humidity on the islands, the film badges failed at a rate of 90 to 100% of the time.
Oh, wow. That they would just continue this mission.
4,300 men.
Oh!
On these islands. 4,300 men. Over, because they were only sent at 6 months at a time, so it was like men would filter through.
Oh, okay. That's a lot more people than I was anticipating.
Yeah. Every evening, workers were scanned for plutonium particles before they left Runet Island. Especially the guys that were working on Runet, putting stuff in the crater.
Let me guess, the scans failed.
Well, dozens screened positive for dangerous levels of radiation every day.
Of course. Of course.
Sometimes we'd get readings that were all the way to the reds in one technician. None of the high readings were recorded. Because they didn't want Congress and reporters and the American public to know that these men were in such danger.
Who made that decision?
It's hard to trace any of this stuff back because they knew what they were doing. And they didn't want there to be a paper trail. Also, at the end of their 6 month tours, the men were supposed to give blood and urine samples so that they could be tested to see if they were exposed to radiation.
If.
Yeah, exactly.
That's cute.
But those records don't exist.
Of course.
David Phillips from the New York Times says that he was writing an article, and some of the information that I'm talking about today came from this article. He requested these records through the Freedom of Information Act and was told that they could not be found.
They'd be so damning.
And meanwhile,
wow,
the government officials are telling reporters in the United States that they were setting a new standard in safety.
In a way they are.
I mean, they're also setting a new low, but like, yeah. One report said that safety was so strict on the island that it, quote, would be difficult to identify additional safety precautions that could have been taken. As I said before, these men were told that the islands emitted no more radiation than a dental x-ray. But declassified documents now show that Army officials were worried about highly radiologically contaminated areas of these islands.
Of course. I mean, the whole island.
In the end, 110,000 cubic yards of contaminated soil, debris, and plutonium were put into barges, sent to the Cactus Crater on Runet, and thrown into it. This crater, I can't even describe how large it is. 30 feet deep.
Okay.
360 feet wide. Like, think about, like, how big this room is.
Yeah.
So it's like three of it's this like, room
is that
deep.
Like 2.5 stories-ish?
And 360 feet wide. Essentially, it's the size of 2 football fields.
Yeah.
In 1978, once the crater was filled, they put an 18-inch thick concrete cap over the entire dome.
Why not just throw some dirt over it?
The goal was they wanted to make sure that the stuff that was inside the crater couldn't become airborne.
Mm.
So that if there was a big storm or whatever, it wouldn't kick up dust that people could breathe in. So that's why there's a cap over the crater. This will be on our Instagram, but I'm going to show Stephanie a picture of what the crater looks like. It basically looks like a flying saucer crashed on the edge of a tropical island. Like, okay. It's on the edge of the island rising out of the sand.
Whoa, that is big.
It's huge.
Yeah.
They put the cap on in 1979. In 1980, the operation was officially closed. They said that the southern islands of Inuitok were safe for habitation, and the Marshallese who came from Inuitok were allowed to return, and did return in 1980. The original budget for this was $40 million. Mm-hmm. Congress said, no, that's too much. How about $20 million? Yeah. Do you want to take a stab at how much we actually ended up spending by 1980?
$10
million? $239 million.
Oh!
Couldn't you have just given that to the Marshallese?
Yeah.
$239 million.
So they were really trying to be cheap.
Yeah.
With like the 20.
Yeah, $40 million like, is even like yeah. really,
yeah, that's
really
like,
ambitious.
Maybe they came in like under somehow because no one has safety suits. Like no. That's how they cut back. But whoa.
I'm guessing what the problem was that they were like, oh, we're just going to go in and like sweep up some sand and it's the end of the day. But then once they got there, they were like testing it and like, no, it's still contaminated. No, it's still contaminated. No, it's still contaminated. I don't really know.
Yeah.
Hmm. So it's 1980. The dome is capped. The operation is over. The Marshallese move back to when we talk. Guess what happens to the vets?
They all get sick and die.
After their 6 months tours on when we talk, they get to go home and watch their bodies slowly deteriorate. Within years, they started seeing brittle bones, infertility,
of course, yeah.
cancer, tumors.
Yeah.
Many of them even fathered children with birth defects.
Of course.
Yeah. Some of the guys talk about infertility being like 22 years old and being told you can never have children. Ron Madden says that he thought it was kind of weird when one of his teeth fell out when he was 29.
Oh!
And within a year, he had lost most of his teeth. They just fell out.
Oh!
So in the next 3 decades after his teeth fell out, Madden developed bone pain, severe joint weakness, and trouble using his arms and legs. He also developed 3 different forms of cancer. In 1990, he lost his left lung.
Holy shit.
He says, my doctor said that I could have smoked 3 packs a day and still wouldn't have had that much damage. Jim Andrell's doctor found a 7.5-pound malignant tumor in his abdomen.
Whoa.
Tim Snyder had tumors on his ribs, spine, and skull.
Whoa.
Bone tumors. Others developed degenerative bone disease and spinal stenosis.
I have the bone structure of a 70-year-old man.
My doctor tells me I've got the bones of a 90-year-old man.
I ended up with late-stage colon cancer. Our first one was born with a stroke in utero. His doctor asked if any of us were exposed to radiation, because he says it's the number one cause.
And when I try to talk to doctors about ionizing radiation, they back up and says, well, I'm not familiar with that.
I have had four cancers. I've had three different forms of cancer.
I've had 20 major back surgeries, 9 spinal fusions, 14 on my right leg where they did a total knee replacement, 1 on my right shoulder, 2 on my left. I have problems breathing. I contributed it to my time on NOE Talk and to what I was exposed to.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah. Paul Laird, the guy who I mentioned before, who was begging his superior officer for a dust mask, a paper dust mask. When he was 52, they found a lump that turned out to be kidney cancer. And when they were scanning him for the kidney cancer at the hospital, they found out that at the same time, he also had bladder cancer. Within a few years, he developed a second form of bladder cancer. And within the years after that, he developed both forms of bladder cancer a second time. So he had bladder cancer 4 times.
Wow.
His private health insurance covered his treatments, but he was drowning in debt from the co-payments.
Of course, yeah.
He applied for free veterans health care for radiation exposure through the VA.
Okay.
But...
Oh, no, I don't want to hear a but.
Yeah. His military records say that he was never exposed to radiation. When the job was done, they threw my bulldozer in the ocean because it was so hot. If it got that much radiation, how the hell did it miss me?
And throwing it in the ocean?
Oh, they threw all sorts of fun shit in the ocean, yeah. I mentioned in the last episode that they were sinking entire battleships.
Or they were trying to wash away radiation.
Yeah. Unfortunately, in March of 2019, this year, Paul Laird died of esophageal cancer. In 1988, Congress passed a law that grants automatic medical care for the veterans that were involved in atomic testing. This healthcare coverage only covers veterans up until 1962, when atomic testing stopped. Because the NWE Talk veterans, the cleanup vets, were not present when the bombs were actually tested, the U.S. government does not recognize them as atomic veterans.
Why not?
Because they weren't there, and there was no risk. Officially, there was no risk of exposure.
What year was this again? This is
77 through 80.
They knew there was a risk.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to incur the cost.
Exactly. The U.S. government does not recognize them as atomic veterans, so they are not eligible for radiation exposure compensation through the VA.
Okay, so about their class action lawsuit.
Funny you mention that.
Okay.
If a private contractor had been hired, if they were able to find anyone and wanted to pay for a private contractor to go in and do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then these private contractors found out later that there were declassified documents saying that they weren't following their own safety programs and that they were worried about all this highly contaminated radiological exposure. A private contractor would be able to sue the U.S. government. Because they're veterans... they do not have the right to sue the United States government because of a 1950 Supreme Court ruling that says that veterans and their family do not have the right to sue the U.S. government for injuries incurred during military service.
I get that in theory.
Yeah.
But they were lied to?
Because in theory, they were signed up for this.
Yeah. Had they been fully informed of the risks? Yeah, this is such garbage.
Really, their only option at this point is to individually apply to the Department of Veterans Affairs for free medical care and disability payments. But because the Department of Veterans Affairs also bases their decisions on old military records, these claims are usually denied. The clips that I'm putting in the show come from a documentary short by a man named Brian Cowden, who has worked really closely with these vets and with the Marshallese. He told me, I've actually spoken with him on the phone quite a bit and got some information from him.
Oh, cool.
He told me that if you're on an overseas mission, it goes onto your military record after 180 days, okay. 6 months.
Okay.
The military strategically pulled these men off the tours before the 6 months was up. So it's not even on their records a lot of time. The government says there is no connection between veterans' illnesses and the cleanup effort of NWE Talk. This was the late 70s. They're kids in the late 70s. Today, they should be in their late 50s or early 60s. Most of them are already dead. 85% of them died before the age of 50.
Wow.
Of the over 4,000 men who went to NWE Talk, According to my research, there are less than 300 left today. The one sort of thing, the one good thing, I can't, I mean, it's not good, but like,
nothing is
there,
good.
There are some people in the government who are trying to get it so that these men would be considered atomic vets and they would be able to have access to health care. In 2015, Representative Mark Takei from Hawaii introduced the Atomic Veterans Healthcare Parity Act, but it never really got anywhere. The following year, Senator Al Franken introduced the Senate version of the same bill. It never made a floor vote. And this bill has been reintroduced every single year since and has never moved beyond the committee stage.
Everyone on this committee needs to be fired.
Ken Kasich said, our boys worked a six-month tour on a dirty island, and the government says you were never there. We were never acknowledged. We don't exist. But Kasich is also worried about the mess left behind for the Marshallese. He said, America dumped all of their worst rubbish to the Marshallese and abandoned them with it. And we don't want to hear about it. It's a disgusting shame. It makes us look bad. There are people living on InWeTalk today. They do not tend to go to Runet Island. They try to avoid it. They're worried about, they call it the tomb. This Runet Dome is called the tomb. They're worried about the radiation that comes off of it. It is technically said to be off limits. However, it is not marked in any way. It is not guarded. It's just this island in the middle of the ocean sitting there. Mark Sargent said that in 1979, when the dome was capped, they never put any structural support or rebar or anything in the cap to prevent the concrete cap from cracking apart.
Oh.
It's going to eventually breach and go into the ocean. There are big time cracks. We never put any liners, stuff we were supposed to
do. They never put any liners?
Yeah, you might remember
they
that I said...
They never put any liners?
In the beginning of this, I said that the $40 million was supposed to cover the cost of lining the crater with concrete. Yeah. The porous lining.
Of course. Yeah. Yes. Congress
said it was too expensive, so they skipped it.
Oh, okay.
They just threw all the shit in the crater as it was.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in.
In 2013, a report by the U.S. Department of Energy found that radioactive materials were already leaching out. Climate change activist Elson Kellen says that dome is the connection between the nuclear age and the climate change age. It'll be a very devastating event if it really leaks. We're not just talking the Marshall Islands. We're talking the whole Pacific. Columbia University's Michael Gerard said, already the sea sometimes washes over the dome in a large storm. The United States government has acknowledged that a major typhoon could break it apart and cause all of the radiation in it to disperse.
Sea level rise is coming.
And I showed you the picture. Yeah. It is literally sitting on the right edge of the island.
Yeah.
It's right there.
Like a bad storm and it's already covered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A 2014 report by the government said that a catastrophic failure of the structure would not necessarily lead to any increase in contamination of the surrounding areas. Because today, the Marshall Islands are already considered to be 10 times more radioactive than Chernobyl. 10 times more radioactive.
10 times? Yeah, there's people who are living there.
I'm persuaded that the radiation outside the dome is as bad as the radiation inside the dome, says Michael Gerard. And therefore, it is a tragic irony that the U.S. government may be right, that if the materials were to be released, the already bad state of the environment around there wouldn't get that much worse.
Does Japan know about this?
Australia, Japan, Southeast Asia, they're right there.
They're right there.
I mean, thousands of miles, but like...
But that's nothing.
I know.
With the 10 times Chernobyl?
Yeah.
That's nothing.
I already mentioned in the last episode about Castle Bravo that there's a huge increase in the rates of cancer and birth defects for people living in the Marshall Islands. But now, especially the people of InWeTalk are starting to move away from their traditional diets because they're so worried about the contamination of the local fish and the lagoons and the coconut trees and the breadfruit trees. So now they're eating like processed and packaged foods that come from somewhere else. And today, the Marshallese are said to have some of the highest rates of diabetes in the entire world. So that's it. That's my story.
Thank you for ending there because I'm like, I have nothing to say.
Yeah. I told you this one was going to be a bummer.
Right now. Thank you for telling that story.
I mean,
it's a good, I mean,
I don't want to tell this. It's
awful. I found scandals that I'm like, oh, this is too dark. Like, I put on the back burner, but I don't think I've ever seen anything like this. I am so just like physically, like I feel so heavy weight. It's a lot.
I really had a hard time with this one because I knew I needed to tell the story.
Yeah.
That people need to hear the story.
You can't look away. You're like, I need to do it. That's how I felt with the Trail of Tears. I'm like, when you see things, especially when you see things that people don't know about, you feel like you need to tell people.
But it's overwhelming too. You know, it's hard. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, we should get some new drinks.
I need all the rum right now.
Yeah, we need
all
to take a little break, a breather from that, and we'll be back with hopefully a little bit of a lighter story next.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh man, you guys.
We took a little break there. It might be a good idea for you to do the same. We had a couple drinks, ate some cheese, listened to some Lizzo.
Yes.
Shook it out.
Because it is heavy.
Exercise the demons.
Yeah. So my story is, I mean, anything is more upbeat than that, you know? My scandal this episode is the DNC of 1944, when the choice of running mate completely changed the course of American history. Tux, your face is amazing right now. I know that you know this.
I know. Yeah. I know enough about the story to be excited about it.
Yeah. We both watched the same documentary that mentioned this. It's on Netflix. It's Oliver Stone's Untold History of the United States.
Yeah.
And when you said that you were watching it too, I'm just like, no, not my scandals. My beautiful scandals.
I know. This story has been on my list.
Because I was like watching it, taking notes. I have so many scandals from it.
You know, these stories, the Castle Bravo and stuff, came from that too. He barely talks about them, but like...
Yeah, like a few sentences. Mm-hmm. Like, hey, we did this thing in the Bikini Atoll. The end.
I started researching it because of that.
Really? Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So at this convention, Henry A. Wallace, FDR's current VP, is dropped. He is dumped by the right wing of the Democratic Party in favor of Harry S. Truman. So this is the single most consequential vice presidential choice in modern times. And it all happened in the blink of an eye, behind closed doors, away from the public. He's dumped like he's an original member of Destiny's Child. Like, his name is Latavia or Latoya. He's here one day, he's gone the next. It is fucked up.
Yeah.
So backroom dealing and party politics are as old as parties themselves, as we learned in episode 3. In the background for the Alien and Sedition Act, I talked about how in our very first election, there was instances of delegate voter manipulation. So this is something that politics emerged early in our young republic. It has never left. So did you know that FDR had not one or two, but three different VPs? Did you know that?
Three? No, I didn't realize three.
Oh.
I knew that there were two. I knew that Truman was different from Wallace.
Yeah.
Who's the third?
Garner is his last name. He served for two terms, and then it was...
Oh.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, two terms, and then it was Wallace, and then it was Truman for the fourth term.
Okay.
In modern times, we kind of think that the presidency is a package deal. At least that's kind of how I think.
Yeah. Well, that's like in the last episode, Andrew Johnson was Lincoln's second VP.
It was not always the case.
Yeah, I didn't.
At all.
Yeah.
Because people died and like just there were a lot of different reasons why the VP kind of shuffled.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it drastically changed the course of history, as is in this case. So we must remember that FDR did not get elected as the progressive we know him as today.
Yeah.
I'm going to say that again for the people in the back. FDR did not get elected as the progressive we know him as today because he was part of the Democratic Party. And this is the Democratic Party before the switch.
Yes. He was sort of instrumental in like the beginning of the switch. But
definitely. He came for President Hoover from the right, like his predecessor.
Wow.
Yeah, for being a big spender and for unbalancing the budget.
I did not
so
know
that.
So
he was out in the street like talking muy caliente, like prior to taking office. Yes. So this is not the Democratic Party that we know and hate.
Yeah.
Is what I was trying to say. The party has always had a mixed legacy, But progressive promise wasn't really the consistent vibe until the mid-1930s. Democrats were still the very, like, racist small government types, while Republicans supported a powerful federal government. But sometime between the 1860s and 1936, things start to change. The party of small government became the party of big government. The party of big government at least became rhetorically committed to curbing federal power. So historians say, this is like a little side note, that Republicans have always been the party of bigger business. It's just that in the earlier era, the bigger businesses wanted a bigger government because they needed things from the government, like infrastructure, they needed a currency, they needed tariffs, they needed all these things. But in the modern era, it's like, we got this thing. Like, we don't need you anymore. We don't need
more of it.
Yeah. So they're like, I don't know you, girl.
When they say small government, generally it does not mean an actual smaller government than we currently have. What they want is just the same size government in the hands of fewer people.
Yes. And not looking at business.
Yeah.
With scrutiny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because it's in the hands of business, essentially.
Exactly. Yeah. They want to just be like, I don't know you. Like,
yeah.
Big business and government, they like see each other on the subway and like hiding.
We've never met.
We've never met. You have me confused. I'm not me. So yeah, so this shift in ideology was largely due to the rise of a really powerful, labor movement that was just coming online. It became the new backbone of the Democratic Party. President Roosevelt's smashing victory in 1936. I don't know if you've seen the electoral map.
No.
For 19. Okay. I've never seen a map like this before in my life.
Which year again?
1936. His second term in office. So I'm just going to show you the map. Thank you for having that reaction. Yes. So it revealed that the political landscape had shifted.
God, what is that? One state, Maine?
Maine and Vermont are the only states that didn't go for the Democrats. Vermont and Maine.
That's insane.
The whole thing.
Also, I feel like Vermont and Maine are now considered pretty progressive, which is a funny...
It's crazy. So things had really shifted. With FDR at its head, the Democratic Party put together a really formidable coalition from coastal intellectuals to lower income groups in the big cities. So like union members, recent immigrants, religious minorities, together with the traditional source of Democratic power, the South.
Yeah.
It is everyone except for Vermont and Maine that's together in this coalition.
I'm trying to picture what the political landscape must have been then.
Look at you thinking over there.
I need to just drink rum and stop, turn my brain off.
Think quieter, okay? So the great migration of Black Americans from the terrorism in the South to the urban North started in 1910 and really gained a lot of steam in the 40s because of World War II.
Yeah.
So they were moving up to the North, and of course there was still segregation, there was still racism, there was still discrimination in housing and employment, but at least they were allowed to vote. They could vote without dying in the North. Even though FDR wasn't super committed to civil rights in any meaningful way at the time, they broke with the party of Lincoln for the first time and they voted for FDR in this election.
Wow.
So FDR claimed, and he was, I think, definitely correct, he claimed that endorsing any legislation that threatened the South's racial order would cost him the votes of the Southerners in Congress. Votes that he desperately needed to get his New Deal policies passed.
Yeah.
So he wrote the New Deal in a way that it could be applied in unequal ways, basically. That the South could...
In unequal ways.
In equal
yes, absolutely.
Ways. Yeah. It was the only way, because the South, they don't want equality.
No.
It would have been destabilizing, and he would have lost all of the South, which was...
Oh, it's so hard for me to keep my mouth shut through this, because I know too much.
I'm like...
The racist ways the New Deal was put into place in the South.
I haven't really looked at that in depth, but I know that it was fucked up. So maybe I'll let you handle that, and I just won't even look into it.
I don't know. I mean, it's one of those stories where, like...
Is it any worse than the story you just fucking told? Okay.
That's true. That is true.
I am not okay.
Will we ever be the same again?
I have therapy on Tuesday night, so we will be talking about this. So FDR was a pragmatic politician in a coalition landscape, and he sort of just rode the wave. He wasn't like super ideological. He could get down with progressive values if it meant winning in saving capitalism. His stronghold on this really wide variety of voters was largely due to the social, political, economic, and cultural changes that were happening at the time. So it was the Great Depression, it was the New Deal, and World War II. So there's just like so many things happening at once.
Yeah.
So there's this rising tide of liberalism, like a coming right now. So when Henry A. Wallace came on the scene, he became the most vocal part of a really growing progressive wing of the party that was at odds with the Southern Democrats. A quick bit about him. I'm not going to go too in detail because I'm just obsessed. He was born the third Henry Wallace to a family with really deep agricultural roots. R. Henry was a plant geneticist by profession. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, he was a scientist. He would go on to develop the first commercially successful hybrid corn.
Wow.
A scientist.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh. When his father, who served as the Secretary of Agriculture for President Warren G. and Calvin C.
Huh, okay.
When his father died, Henry became a national farming authority by default. As a family, the Wallaces were Republican, but the shock of the Great Depression had a really big impact on rural America, and it forced Henry to reevaluate his politics. In 1932, Wallace supported Franklin Roosevelt, who in turn elected Wallace as his Secretary of Agriculture. So he got his like dad's old job.
Wow, okay.
Again, Henry Wallace to me is one of the most fascinating political figures in American history. The documentary on Netflix really like talks him up because he was so revolutionary in so many ways.
Yeah.
And I didn't learn about him in school. Did you ever learn about?
Yeah,
right?
Not at all.
And it's crazy.
I would think a lot of the listeners today probably have never even heard of him.
Yeah, it took me forever to write this outline because it kept sounding like a fawning book report. Just like, I love Henry Wallace, let me count the ways. Sort of thing. I'm like, okay.
Stephanie Wallace.
Yeah, it's like me in a heart. It's like S plus H equals, yeah. So he was a serious, really serious guy. Like, he was an author, he was a lecturer, he was a very, very committed social rights advocate. He was a New Deal hype man, basically. Like, he was truly down for the cause, and he had a large, really devoted following because of it. So he, in 1940, was the most popular Democrat in the country.
In 1940, okay, wow.
Second to only FDR, their wartime president.
Yeah, sure.
So everyone loves him, basically. But he was a very easy man to make fun of.
Okay. Nerd.
Yeah. To these tough party loyalists, Wallace seemed to have his head in the clouds. He was always reading and trying to know things.
Loser.
The machine never wanted him as VP. They thought him too liberal, too internationalist, too soft.
Okay, yeah.
And also they didn't trust him because he only recently became a Democrat.
Oh, yeah,
because
yeah.
Because his family was Republican, and the Great Depression caused them to switch. But it also didn't help that Henry was a Buddhist mystic who spoke Russian and played with a boomerang and apparently consulted with the spirit of a dead Sioux Indian chief.
Oh, okay.
I'm not going to say anything about that because I'm going to revisit Wallace in other ways.
Okay.
So I'm just going to leave that there and move on real quick. So, again, FDR wasn't ideological. He didn't mind that Wallace was such an oddball because he was a popular oddball.
Sure. Okay.
Everyone loved him. FDR wanted an outspoken anti-fascist on the ticket, which Wallace was, given what he predicted we would be up against in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it was good to have someone that was, like, very committed to anti-fascism.
Before Antifa was a bad word.
You guys, this was back when we all knew Nazis were bad. I like that you laugh. You almost spit your drink out. Oh, my God.
Imagine an entire nation believing that Nazis are bad.
Right? Yeah.
Americans? Never.
We were such a young country. Oh, so naive. Leading up to the convention, FDR wrote that we already have one conservative Wall Street-dominated party in the U.S., the Republicans. And if Democrats aren't going to be a liberal pro-social justice party, they have no reason to exist.
Yeah.
So he threatened to turn down the nomination if he couldn't get Wallace as his VP.
Wow.
Yeah. So FDR is starting to get a little woke, and it's all because of Eleanor.
Eleanor
loved Wallace, loved everything he stood for. They were great friends. Like, Yeah, Eleanor is the reason that Wallace was even on his radar.
Shocking, right?
So she really is the reason why we had Wallace at all as VP.
Wow.
She took to the convention in 1940, and she warned everyone that their beloved wartime president would not run for a third term. He was going to take his ball and go home if he couldn't have Wallace on the ticket.
Wow.
She said this all in this really amazing speech. It's, yeah, I'm gonna link it in the show notes. It's incredible. Okay. So they, the right-wing machine operatives who controlled the party behind the scenes, they begrudgingly agreed to have Wallace on the ticket in 1940. So as the New Deal was losing momentum, Wallace became its most forceful defender. At the same time, he anticipated problems that were not yet on many people's minds. He was so ahead of his time.
This is, again, 1940.
This is 1940, yes.
Okay.
This is 1940. So he wrote that, quote, probably the most damaging indictment that can be made of the capitalistic system is the way in which its emphasis on unfettered individualism results in the exploitation of natural resources in a manner to destroy the physical foundations of national longevity. Exactly.
I'm gooped. I literally...
Right?
We were saying... Climate somebody fucking was saying change this in the 40s?
The 1940.
How?
Because he's a scientist, though.
Oh, my God.
He's a plant geneticist. He's like, oh, shit.
Before, like, climate change was even, like, a thing that we would even
before
have to
Before it was a Chinese hoax, you mean?
Wow.
Yes, right?
I need to find my trapper keeper. Cross out.
Why?
Cross out Eleanor.
Oh, yes.
And put Wallace in my heart.
You can be a my trapper keeper.
Yeah. Ooh.
You gave me that word when you were talking about what's his name with eyebrows?
Warren.
Or no. Levy.
Levy.
Yeah.
Yeah. The whole corn thing, too, is like his research led him to like have modified corn, and now we're like getting into GMO shit.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't know where his research was going to go.
He didn't know, but he was a curious person, and everyone was on that march towards progress.
The goal was just more food for...
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's why he did it.
Yeah.
That's why he did it.
They didn't know we would be getting into
He's
some
like, this
Monsanto
is a more efficient
shit.
Way to propagate corn. Oh, he's amazing. So, do you know who Henry Luce is?
No.
He is a newspaper. He was a newspaper magnate. He owned, like, every magazine. He owned Time, Life, Sports Illustrated, Fortune. Like, he was he owned everything. He was the most influential private citizen of his day.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, by far, because he owned all of these
real
media.
Real-life Citizen Kane.
Yes.
Yeah.
Actually, yes. Correct. He wrote... that, quote, the 20th century must be the American century, and that the U.S. should dominate the world militarily, economically, culturally, etc. He wrote this long, like, really long piece, I think, in Life.
Okay.
About how this is our century, this is our time. Britain is declining. Like, it is our time after the war to, like, rise up.
Funny to think about, like, this was the mindset at that time, and, like, looking forward to where we are now when we're on the decline.
So, I think it was in Oliver Stone's documentary, I think it was Churchill who said, if it is really going to be the American century, may God help us all.
It's a shame that God didn't help us all. And here we are, 2019.
So Wallace counters with a really rousing speech on why the 20th century must be the century of the common man, and he calls for a worldwide people's revolution. He said, some have spoken, quote, of the American century. I say that the century on which we are entering, the century which will come out of this war, can and must be the century of the common man. There must be neither military nor economic imperialism, international cartels that serve American greed, and the German will to power must go. The people's revolution is on the march, and the devil and all of his angels cannot prevail against it. Yeah.
Damn. Big words.
Big words. He was such a great orator.
Yeah.
He was amazing. He spoke from the heart. Like, you could tell that he really cared.
Damn.
And
this
he's
is
like,
another, like,
it should not be the American century. It needs to be everyone. Like, it shouldn't be one big superpower fucking everyone over again. Like, we need to be in this together.
Yeah. This is another Shirley Chisholm situation where no one was listening.
Yeah. Sure was. Yeah. So I'm doing, like, in my head, I've said, like, every season I'm going to do one person who's just the best and no one knows about them.
Yeah.
So I did Shirley Chisholm, and, like, Wallace is my next one for season two.
The season two Chisholm. Yeah.
Yeah. So it is Wallace who knew that fascism could come here. He knew that this was not strictly a problem of Europe. Also known as Europe.
Europe.
He said that American fascists are those who put Wall Street first and the American people second.
Big facts.
Yeah.
So, coming at you.
So he's basically talking about the contemporary Democratic and Republican parties.
Yeah.
However, he said American fascism wouldn't be a problem unless three conditions are met. Quote, American fascism will not be really dangerous until there's a purposeful coalition amongst the cartelists. That's one. The deliberate poisoners of public information. That's two. And those who stand for the KKK type demagoguery. Three. I mean, he didn't number them, but I did. But I'm like, oh, we're hitting all three.
Okay.
Yeah.
So essentially, he was just like, he was the oracle.
Yeah. He was reading 2019.
Yeah.
From the 40s.
Yeah. Oh, man.
Right? So I have a clip.
When these opportunities are open to everyone, then the world moves straight ahead. But in countries where the ability to read and write has been recently acquired, mind you, 62% of the people of the world today do not yet know how to read and write. But in those countries where the ability has been recently acquired, or where the people have had no long experience in governing themselves on the basis of their own thinking, it is easy for demagogues to arise and prostitute the mind of the common man to their own base end. Such a demagogue may get financial help from some person of wealth who is unaware of what the end result will be. With this backing, the demagogue may dominate the minds of the people, and from whatever degree of freedom they have, lead them back into a most degraded slavery. Herr Thiessen, the wealthy German steel man, little realized what he was doing when he gave Hitler enough money to enable him to play on the minds of the German people. The demagogue is the curse of the modern world.
Right.
Damn.
So to make matters even worse, he was the leading spokesman for civil rights. He called for equal pay for equal work, regardless of race or sex.
Oh, my word.
So across the board, he represents everything we see as good with American progressivism. And they hated him for it. So he would be more of a Liz Warren type person, minus the really shameful Native American appropriation, because Wall Street was like pissing in their britches at the thought of him becoming president.
Yeah.
So 44 is when the next election has happened. This is like leading up to the convention. There was still a lot of really strong support for Wallace, despite his leftist leanings. Like, people loved him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everyone loved him.
I love him.
Yeah, I love him too.
Yeah.
But Edwin Pauley, who was the DNC treasurer and just resident busybody, he ran what he called the Pauley's coup. Super creative. He proudly referred to his coup by name like a loser. Him and his homies basically plotted to dump Wallace. Pauley was an oil tycoon from California, a really big fundraiser who just so happened to be besties with Truman. Okay. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So he, in conjunction with Bob Hannigan, who was the DNC chair, they had the Bronx boss, Edward Flynn. They had Chicago's mayor, Ed Kelly, who's big trash. They had key labor leaders and other party like movers and shakers. They viewed Wallace as a huge liability for his leftist leanings. So these people ran a very targeted operation to get Truman elected VP behind Wallace's back. Like, wow. They actually prevented Wallace's supporters, like delegates that would have supported him, from having access to FDR.
I can't say that I'm surprised, but right? Holy shit.
There was a very deep division over who Roosevelt should choose as a running mate. For his fourth term, exactly.
Yeah,
okay. For a reason that really transcended political boundaries, for the reason that he was dying. FDR was really, really weak by 1944.
I was just going to say, like, he knew that he was sick.
It was clear to
everyone. Everyone around him knew he was sick.
Yeah, it was... It seemed clear to everyone but him that he wasn't going to make it through a fourth term. So for that reason, the stakes were higher because it was like electing a president.
100%.
Because it would be electing a president. And there was no shortage of hopeful candidates because of it.
Yeah.
But Truman wasn't one of them.
Because he's a fucking turd.
Exactly.
Sorry, but Truman's a turd.
He totally was. So FDR, it's hard to know what he was really doing. He was doing a lot in 1944. So FDR hating to disappoint and alienate any of his potential candidates, VP candidates, kept them all guessing. This is so crazy. So at lunch with Wallace, Roosevelt told him that even though Truman's qualifications were limited, the party machine preferred him because he had no enemies. So Truman was a failed shopkeeper who rose to the Missouri Senate with the help of a powerful boss in Kansas City named Tom Pendergrass, who, after he was turned down by four different people, four dudes said no. He selected Truman saying, quote, "I wanted to demonstrate that a well-oiled machine could send an office boy to the Senate."
An office boy.
I know, it's so upsetting. However, Roosevelt promised Wallace that he would not endorse another candidate. He would notify the convention that if he were a delegate, he would vote for Wallace. Which is such a weird, like, that's not an endorsement. Especially
not at all.
Especially from 1940, like, when Wallace was his ride or die, saying, like, if I can't have you, I'm like, I'm burning this shit down. We're gonna, like, Thelma and Louise this shit.
What happened in the last 4 years? I mean,
I think it's just he's so sick.
But he's tired.
But who fucking knows? But yeah, that's...
By this point, he's been president for, what, 12 years already?
So if I were a delegate, I would vote for you. Like, that's not an endorsement at all.
Yeah.
But that's what he told Wallace. Another VP candidate was a man named James Burns, who went by Jimmy.
Yeah.
I'm like, that disqualifies you. I'm sorry. There's not going to be a VP Jimmy anything. Get the fuck out of here.
Carter, right?
Oh, shit. Jimmy is stupid. Sorry, Carter. Jimmy is stupid. It just is.
Tim, you know what to do with that.
So Jimmy Burns, he was FDR's right hand, who oddly enough asked Truman to nominate him at the convention. And they were all kind of friends.
Yeah.
So at the same time, the president held out hopes to Burns, telling him that he was the best qualified man for the whole outfit and urged him to stay in the race. He said, "After all, Jimmy, you're close to me, personally, and I hardly know Truman." So despite encouraging both Wallace and Burns, FDR had written a letter for Hannegan, who's the DNC chair again, to carry to the convention that wrote, "Dear Bob, you've written me about Harry Truman and Bill Douglas." Bill Douglas was a Supreme Court justice at the time.
Okay.
He says, "I should, of course, be very glad to run with either one of them and believe that either one of them would bring real strength to the ticket." I don't know what's going on, but he's just being really ambiguous with everything.
Yeah. That's so weird. I didn't really know any of this.
I know. Like, reading it, I was like, I don't get why he's doing it. And no one knows why he was doing this. People just think that maybe he was just getting really, really sick. And
He was.
So meanwhile, Senator Truman continued to deny any interest in the vice presidency. In an off-the-record interview, he explained to a reporter that he did not want to subject his family to the negative publicity involved in a national campaign. It turns out that both him, his wife, and his sister were on his payroll, his Senate payroll, so that's probably why. But his wife and his mom wanted him to stay in the Senate. Yeah, it's like, why is your mom commenting on this? You're 50, but okay.
FDR's mom also had a lot of influence too. So
yeah. So do you know who said that the vice president simply presides over the Senate and sits around hoping for a funeral?
No, but I love them for saying that.
Truman. Truman said this.
Wow.
Because, again, he did not want to be VP. So he was speaking honestly. The VP to him was a position of honor and no real power. He wanted to be majority leader.
Okay.
He wanted real power.
Sure. Okay.
So the VP is just sitting around, like, breaking ties? Like,
I mean, I get that. But at the same time, like, he had to see the writing on the wall. He had to see how sick.
He's not bright.
Yeah, he's not bright.
He's not bright. He's not bright.
I hate to drag the man, but like, he is the pre GW.
He's the only one who didn't see anything.
Yeah. He's essentially like the George W. Bush of the 1940s.
Absolutely. The fact that he would say this, knowing that the president is sick, but like, not a clue in the world.
FDR died, what, 80 days into his fourth term?
Yeah, 3 months. Yeah, less than 3 months away. Yeah. But the bosses wanted him for this role. Wallace was too radical. Jimmy Burns was equally vulnerable because he had a segregationist kind of history. They felt like that might, because things have shifted so much.
And people were more progressive at this point.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Like that was a hindrance for him. So when these party leaders expressed their opposition to Wallace and Burns, who were the front runners at the time, Roosevelt again suggested Supreme Court Justice Douglas. And it's like, why is this dude even in here? But okay. So the group again countered with Harry Truman, who Roosevelt agreed had been, quote, loyal and wise to the ways of politics, which I don't even know what that means. I guess he's a yes man.
Like, what are you even talking about, dude?
FDR is kind of losing it a bit. Oh. So after much discussion, apparently Roosevelt turned to Hannegan and conceded, Bob, I think you and everyone else here want Truman. So they finally wore him down, basically.
Yeah.
Now they just had to get Truman on board. Yeah.
Wow.
Right? Okay. So huddled in a hotel room.
Really? This is during the... dude didn't even want it.
Not at all. Didn't want it at all. So huddled in a hotel room during the convention, the party bosses leaned heavily on Truman to run. He was, again, not for it. At the convention, he was still planning on nominating Burns.
Wow.
He wasn't trying to be coy. He did not want the job. So they placed a call to Roosevelt, who, despite his health, was on the campaign trail, which was shocking to me. Truman sat nearby and Hannegan held the phone so he could hear.
Sorry, but why are you on the campaign trail? You're in the middle of a war. People are going to vote for you.
Yeah. I think he was trying to prove his vitality.
Oh, that makes sense. Yeah.
It was a hard election year. Like, Republicans were running a really strong candidate, so okay. He had to be out and about.
He's also in a wheelchair, which, yeah. Like, he thought that he had something to prove, too.
Yeah, so. I know. It's so sad. So Truman sat nearby, because this phone call that's happening, and Hannegan held the phone so he could hear. He said, quote, Bob, have you got that fellow lined up yet? Roosevelt asked. No, he's the contrariest Missouri mule I've ever met, Hannegan said. Well, you tell him that if he wants to break up the Democratic Party in the middle of the war, that's his responsibility. And he hung up.
The president has spoken.
Yeah. So stunned, Truman agreed to run because, duh, the president just said to run. And he said, why the hell didn't he tell me that in the first place? Which is legitimate.
Like, literally.
Legitimate. Like, why are we playing all these games with all these, like, the Supreme... Douglas is in here. Like, Walt... Like, just say this. Say what you mean.
What's going on with fucking Wallace at this point? Like, does he know this is happening?
Ugh. I mean, he suspects, like, his people, they don't have access.
Yeah.
The access that they once had to Roosevelt. Polly's coup is, like, keeping them at bay.
Okay.
So he knew that the party didn't want him.
Sure.
But he didn't know the levels of it. So,
and that, like, Roosevelt has already turned
on him. He did not know that. Okay. He did not know that at all. So, essentially, they cooked the convention. They stacked the DNC with anti-Wallace delegates. There's still one huge problem. Wallace is insanely popular. There's, like, thousands of labor leaders who've organized for him at the convention. So, a Gallup poll the opening day of the convention shows 65% of people wanted Wallace. 3% wanted Jimmy Burns. Truman is in 8th place with 2%. 8th. So Wallace was so popular the night of the convention starts, he made the second speech for Roosevelt, because I guess you have to be nominated and someone has to second you. Like, that's how, like, the process goes. So even though the party bosses had the convention stacked and fixed, Wallace's rousing speech, a speech that was interrupted constantly by applause and shouts of, we want Wallace. Like, he had to stop so many times. Like, I will put this in the show notes, the actual speech. He stopped, like, 20 different times of a short speech. Yeah. So after this, a spontaneous demonstration on the floor happens. It lasts for a whole hour. The people of the convention are on Wallace's side. They're singing. They're chanting.
It's a flash mob. Wallace flash mob.
I mean, kind of, yeah. Someone even hijacked the loudspeaker and started playing Wallace's campaign song. So a Wallace victory seemed certain. In the midst of the demonstration, there's a senator, a Florida senator named Claude Pepper, who was nicknamed Red Pepper because he was really progressive. When I saw that his nickname was Red Pepper, I'm like, is he like a ginger?
No, he's a red.
He's a red. He saw what was happening and he realized that if he could just get to the microphone and get Wallace's name in the nomination for VP, Wallace would be back on the ticket and he would sweep the convention that night if they voted.
Okay.
He kind of fought his way to the microphone, and the party bosses, because they had, like, plants everywhere, they see that this is happening. So the Polycoup, they asked Mayor Kelly of Chicago, because the convention is happening in Chicago. They asked Kelly to shut down the convention for the night due to a fire hazard.
To keep this guy from even nominating Wallace.
Exactly.
Holy shit.
They ordered the music to stop, because, you know, when you chant loud enough for the wrong person, a fire starts.
Yeah.
The chairman of the convention later said that he had strict orders not to let Wallace get the nomination that night, because they knew that it was the will of the people and Wallace would have been instantly back on the ticket. So he called for the meeting to be adjourned to prevent this vote. So he called, like, I have a motion to adjourn. All in favor say aye. Maybe 3% say aye. All opposed say nay. It's like thunderous nay. And he says, wow, the motion passed.
How did they get away with that?
It just did. Instantly, it's over.
Oh my God.
So Pepper was so close. He was 5 feet away, like literal seconds away from getting to the mic. Had he got to the microphone before it was adjourned, he would have been able to put Wallace. They would have had to vote that night.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So had he been a little bit faster, just a like literally 5 seconds faster, a breath faster, Wallace would have been back on the ticket. He would have been voted in as VP that night. He would have become president in 1945, when 3 months after the inauguration, FDR drops dead instead of Truman. But instead, the following night on the first ballot, Wallace led Truman, but the party leaders swung their delegations on the second ballot and they put Truman over the top. And, you know, the rest was history.
This is insane. Wow.
We were so close.
And Truman, ugh, he's the worst.
Yeah.
I don't know if any of you have even heard Truman speak. He's a turd. He's just a turd.
Sure is.
And he also, fast forward, is the one who oversaw us getting into the fucking Marshall Islands and doing all these nuclear tests, because he had a real hard on for like proving how masculine the United States was. And we had
he wanted to be a powerful man to show his mommy.
Literally, we could be living in a different world today.
Radically different.
If Red Pepper had gotten a minute faster.
Yeah. Back when Florida was doing good things.
Oh, Florida.
I know. This is when the Oh, Florida started.
I'm just picturing
Lisa
Simpson.
Yeah.
I'm not a state. I'm a monster.
I'm a monster. Accurate.
Oh, damn.
Yeah, I know.
Is that?
That's it. The end.
Wow.
The end. Because I'm going to revisit Wallace, so I'm just like, I need to end it here. So, yeah. So this is the story of the convention.
Holy
shit. How fucking crazy is that?
I really want to know what Eleanor was doing while FDR was doing all... She had to have known, but at this point in history, she had her own shit going on.
Yeah, I think that's what it was. I think that's what it was, that they, like, there were people who were just, like, surrounding him, and she wasn't there.
Yeah, and probably didn't even really have that much access to him, because people knew what she was doing, too.
Yeah, no, she was part of the problem in their minds.
Yeah.
She wanted equal pay for equal work, commie.
Rights for black people? What the fuck are you thinking,
rights
you crazy
for women?
Bitch?
Women being paid like men? So that's the end of my scandal. I feel like it was a good balance because it was like a positive story.
I needed that.
I mean, it's not a positive story because the ending is horrible, but it's nothing compared to yours.
It's a fun story, though.
It's a fun story.
Just because Wallace is a fun character.
Yeah.
As you are well aware, I love the fucking Roosevelts.
Yeah, you do. You stan.
Should we?
Let's cheers it. Remaining bits of this delicious pina colada.
America's history is juicy.
Yes.
We just add rum and
pineapple.
Put the lime in the coconut.
Yes.
Add some pineapple juice in there somehow. I don't know how that equation works, but
throw in an umbrella.
The pineapple is like the cosine, I think.
Oh, right? Yes.
Yes, a cocktail umbrella, no big deal, some tropical breezes. Mm-hmm. Anyways, thank you so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Doot-doot. Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and podfather. We literally could not do this without you. Special thanks to Brian Cowden, who provided some of the audio clips from my story.
Thank you.
And really helped with a lot of information. Thank you also to all of the vets who were interviewed in Brian's
documentary,
Brian's documentary, which we will link to in the show notes. We'll also try and put that on social media. And if anyone is interested in learning more about that story, please look up Brian's movie and find information. If you're interested in finding ways to help these guys, there's not many of them left. But if you do want to help, try to call your senators, call your representatives, and push them to vote for the Atomic Veterans Healthcare Parity Act, please. I don't want to get back into it, but yeah. Jesus, they need help.
Yeah.
You know? Thank you, everyone who helped in making this episode. Please do rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, you know what to do. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Leaving us a review there helps new people to find our podcast, and it also pushes our show up in the search bar so that it's easier to find us. So take a few seconds and do this if you have a moment. And also, send this episode to a friend or family member.
Or mortal enemy as a way of making peace.
You got to do it somehow.
I mean,
it's been quite a journey.
Yes.
So I guess it's the end.
It's been the end.
Yes. Well, you know what happens when we drink too much? We drag out the ending.
And also we have a great time.
Yes. Was it as good for you as it is for me?
Oh, no. Tim, please save us.
Okay, on that note, bye.
Bye.